You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church.
You know, why do we think that men and women are fundamentally morally equal? That's not a self-evident truth. That's not something that people have always believed or that every culture and philosophy teaches. Absolutely. I mean, it certainly wasn't what was generally thought in the Greco-Roman Empire into which Christianity was born.
Even as it pertains to women, it's not as if Jesus is only harsh to men and only gentle with women. There are men and women that he is gentle towards, and then there are other times where he's more direct, both with men and with women.
If it is true that Christianity is at heart bad for women, it's very strange that women have always been more proportionally drawn to Jesus than men have.
This is Kyle Worley, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rebecca McLaughlin. How are you, Rebecca?
I'm exceedingly well. Thank you, Kyle. How are you?
Exceedingly well. Yes, yes. Well, I'm glad to hear that. What is it like in October in your neck of the woods there in Massachusetts?
I love how you're asking me a question about the weather. It's very English to talk about the weather.
If I speak in the tongues of men, I'm coming to you in a language that you would understand.
I want to hear you speaking in the tongues of angels, Kyle, today, if you can just pull that
out of
me.
Yeah, I think that the audience would be terrified of that notion.
The weather in Boston in the fall in general, it's meant to be our best season. We're known for our leaves. However, today in particular, it's just gloomy and a bit wet.
Yeah, that's how it is here.
So, yeah, I wouldn't rush to Boston for October.
Okay, good to know. Good to know. Well, yeah, that's how it is here. My wife and I have been watching a show that's set in Maine.
Oh, what show?
It's called The Lost Kitchen. Have you heard about the show?
No.
Rebecca,
it sounds incredibly boring.
Trust me, I think you'd be very, very, I'm recommending it to you now, knowing that one day I will read it as an illustration in a book that you write.
Trust me. You thinking as a woman, I'm be really interested in kitchens? Is that what I'm hearing?
I wasn't trying to do that. I think all of us, everyone who likes to eat is interested in kitchens, I think. But this show is fascinating, and I'm not giving like an endorsement for it. They're not a sponsor for the show. Don't cancel me.
Yet.
We haven't finished the whole season. But like it's a reality show based off of restaurant in Maine that like does this. It's a really cool concept. They do seasonal cooking from like April through the end of September. And to get a reservation there, you mail them a postcard. And then they do a postcard lottery, and then they just assign you a date in their like open season. And they just tell you like, hey, you've got this date. You're welcome to come if you'd like.
Goodness.
Isn't that crazy?
I don't think I've ever watched a reality TV show.
What? Ever?
Yeah,
nothing?
I'm scanning my mental records. I don't think I've ever watched even an entire episode. I've watched like maybe 10 minutes of a reality TV show here and there.
Not like Survivor, Big Brother,
no,
Real World,
no,
Road Rules,
no,
Road Rules versus
no,
Real World.
No, not even the Great British Baking Show, as you call it here.
Oh my goodness. No. You don't watch The Bake Off?
Yeah, I don't really believe in reality TV.
I thought you were going to step with reality there. We're going to take this episode in a very different direction. I don't really believe in reality. Okay. That really surprises me. I got to tell you, I would not.
You thought I was sitting here all day long watching reality TV shows?
No. I didn't think that you just had such excess time on your hands. It seems like anytime you have additional time, you're like, you know what? Let me crank out another book based off of from 30,000 feet away of what you're doing with your extra time. So no, I didn't think you were banking a lot of reality TV watching, but to never watch a reality TV show?
I don't think I have.
All right. Well, you're missing out. There's some great stuff out there. One day when you're looking over the whole of your life, you know what you'll think? I wish I would have watched more reality TV show.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
Mm. I'm confident in it. Well, today we're not talking about reality TV, but we are talking about something that is really important.
Oh gosh, Kyle, try again on that segue.
Hold on. Okay. We aren't talking about reality TV today, but we are talking about the the most real thing in the world. Jesus.
Are you a youth pastor?
I know. It's the second one was somehow worse than the first, but it's just, it's early. We're recording this. We're going to jump right into it. Let me start with like a hard hitting question.
I'm ready.
Is there a cultural impression that Christianity is misogynistic? Is that like,
yes.
Okay. So I think I feel that too. Why?
I think it's a whole range of things. There's obviously right now a particular focus on, you know, culturally on women's rights. Mm-hmm. And many in our culture today have come to understand women's rights to include things which Christians simply cannot affirm, in particular, the right to mm-hmm. abort. Yep. So there's that sort of very visceral edge to the conversation.
Yes.
But I think it's also a larger conversation. I remember talking with a non-Christian friend a few years ago who just made the offhand comment that marriage was clearly bad for women. Mm. And I thought at the time, I was like, wow, it was striking to me that she wasn't trying to make a case for that.
Right.
She was stating it as if it was a truth universally acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And I thought, gosh, there are many ways in which I could argue empirically mm-hmm. that is just not true.
Right.
Like even taking out any sort of religious perspectives on the question, the idea that faithful, committed marriage is not good for women is actually not true. But it was fascinating to me that she strongly believed that.
Yeah.
And of course, one of the things that Christians believe in is marriage. Christians also believe in singleness and hold that to very highly, or should. But I think that's one edge as well. And then what we believe about roles in marriage, what we believe about mm-hmm. roles in church, there are all sorts of ways in which people think of Christians as being misogynistic, anti-women.
Yeah. I think you're right. There are a lot of, I think there are some significant misunderstandings about the Christian ethic as it pertains to men and women, what we believe about men and women, who they are, what they are, the way that your unique physiology affects the way they relate to one another or the way they engage in society. And I do think that one of the more interesting things is that it seems like at one point there were, and this is with a lot of different issues, it seems like maybe 10, 15 years ago, there was a willingness to say, okay, yeah, like the Christian gender ethic or Christian views on men and women are repressive, but we understand their role in society. Now it seems like there is an increasing sense of it's inconceivable that we would allow them to continue. Like,
right.
There is like, and there's a lot of these transitions that have taken place, largely in the field of ethics and sexual ethics in particular. But it does seem like one of the more interesting turns of the last 10 years has not just been like, okay, we understand, pat on the head, you're so traditional with your very, old ways, conservative ways of viewing men and women. We understand we've moved beyond that, to a sense of like, no, we have to actually crush that and liberate all forms of restrictions on what men and women are or what they can do. And it does seem to me like the tenor of the disagreement has changed on both sides.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things flowing into that. On the one hand, I do think a lot of misogyny has been passed off under the name of Christianity.
Sure.
Like, let's be honest. Like, there's been plenty of examples, frankly, throughout the last 2,000 years of Christians talking in ways that are demeaning to women, whether explicitly or implicitly.
Sure.
Suggesting that women are somehow lesser than men in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, that's a real part of our history and sadly also a real part of, how some churches operate today. But I don't think it's something that we get from the scriptures.
Right.
And we're always in a position of sort of needing to correct that. But I think it's one of the areas in which the world around us is pointing out some of the ethical kind of mistakes that we have made.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at the same time, I think that the transgender movement, as it calls into question what it means to be a man or a woman in a fresh way, mm-hmm. means that Christians on the one hand are sort of feeling even more on the back foot yep. than usual. Yep. And on the other hand, strangely, and I've been reading a bunch of books in the last year or so by sort of secular feminist mm-hmm. women yep. who are strongly critical of the transgender movement because of the ways in which it undermines our understanding of what a woman even is. I mean, just at a very basic level, you know, you can't really have protections for women if you are not defining women as biological females. Yeah. And in fact, you're kind of allowing anyone, any man to identify as a woman and therefore sort of opt into that category. So I think there are a lot of really complex things happening right now yeah. to where, much to their surprise, some people who would have seen themselves as like absolutely on the opposite side of every possible fence yep. from Christians yep. are finding themselves in a strange kind of alliance. Wait a minute, you guys are the other people who also think yep. that women are biological females. And, you know, we've kind of got to have some sort of teamwork here.
Yeah. And I think it's really important what you said at the beginning of that, which is that there is if we look on the history of most philosophies, religions, worldviews, there can be sometimes a time when we say, hey, we have to acknowledge our failures as a kind of as a group or as a school mm. of thought. And you do, you have to look back and be like, yeah, obviously on a range of issues, as people deal with other people, there have been there have been healthy practices and malpractices of those kinds of mm-hmm. engagements, interactions. And yes, if you look back in the history of Christianity, you'll find misogynism. Just like if you looked in the history of Islam or the history of Nietzschean thought or Darwinian thought or the history of communism, you're going to find misogynism in all of those philosophies. The question is it integral to the engine? Mm-hmm. Right? Is it essential to the message? Is it like what the witness of Scripture is? And you just wrote a book called Jesus Through the Eyes of Women. You took some time aside to really explore like, hey, how did women view Jesus and what were those relationships like? What was that engagement mm-hmm. like? What was the level of conversation, mutuality? How did they see Jesus? How did Jesus engage with them? And so let me ask it this. We've definitely said, and it's true, that there's cultural impressions that Christianity is misogynistic. But mm-hmm. let me ask it differently. As you look at the witness of Scripture, as you look at the ministry of Jesus, is Christianity misogynistic at its core? Is there a engine problem here? As you looked at the witness of Christ, the witness of Scripture, as you wrote this book, as you were reflecting on these topics, did you walk away going, yes, Scripture is written with a view to denigrating, demeaning, and dishonoring women?
No, funnily enough. I think actually, and this is true on a whole host of ethical questions, Scripture is what's giving us our moral standard to judge by in the first place, whether or not we realize it. So, you know, why do we think that men and women are fundamentally morally equal? Now, that's not a self-evident truth.
That's right.
That's not something that people have always believed or that every culture and philosophy teaches. Absolutely. I mean, it certainly wasn't what was generally thought in the Greco-Roman Empire into which Christianity was born.
Yeah.
So actually the ways that Jesus related to women and the things that he taught and the ways in which the Old Testament through Christianity became far more widely read and understood, and the ways in which the New Testament speaks in radical ways about women is the reason why today mm. people think that men and women
yep.
are fundamentally morally equal. So we're kind of, as with many moral questions, we're judging Christians ultimately on the basis of Christian moral
right,
beliefs,
that's right.
whether or not we realize that. And yeah, in that book, I intentionally wrote Jesus Through the Eyes of Women rather than Women Through the Eyes of Jesus, which is also a book that could have been written looking at, you know, what do we learn about women from how Jesus treated them? And I'm not saying that's irrelevant to the project of my book, but actually I wanted to look at what do we learn about Jesus when we pay attention to the women in the Gospels? And one of the things that's fascinating is that actually the gospel authors specifically invite us to look through the eyes of women when it comes to particular moments in Jesus's ministry, and especially when it comes to Jesus's death, burial, and resurrection.
That's right.
You know, they are citing female eyewitnesses in ways which would have been, you know, more evident to their first readers than they are to us. A, how remarkable this is, and B, how clearly they're saying, these are the eyewitnesses that I'm citing in a culture where women's testimony was often dismissed, especially when it came to religious things. So there's something really profound and kind of countercultural going on in the Gospels, which I think we can deeply benefit from today, if that makes sense. Ever since Jesus' female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, seminary president Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort, and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold.
What do you think are the big, when you think about, okay, the perspective of these women looking at Jesus in the Gospels, how does that showcase some unique features or truths of the person ministry of Jesus that we'll lose if we don't look through that gaze?
Yeah, I think in addition to the specific events in Jesus' life that we'd miss, it's funny, if you do the exercise, imagine, and I'm not saying we should do this, but like imagine you went through the Gospels and you cut out everything that is not witnessed by women. You'd actually lose very little in terms of the gospel narratives. You know, there are a handful of situations, like, for example, Jesus' transfiguration, where it seems he only had Peter, James, and John with him.
Right.
Conversely, we'd lose some pretty significant things if we cut out everything that was not witnessed by men. Mm. for instance, the conversation that Mary had with Gabriel when she first heard that she was going to be the mother of God's only son. The incredible conversation that Mary and Elizabeth have when Mary and Elizabeth meet when she's pregnant with Jesus. And, you know, of course, the conversations, I mean, it's unclear whether the other disciples were there as well, but like, you know, Jesus' time with the Samaritan woman, his longest recorded private conversation in any of the Gospels, and in John 4. I'm pretty sure that the male disciples were also there when Jesus taught with Martha of Bethany in John 11. Mm-hmm. And so those incredible words about being in the resurrection and the life. But she's at the front and center of that conversation.
Yep.
And I think we learn a lot about how Jesus makes himself available to people who are on the margins socially.
Mm-hmm.
See that in a lot of different figures in the Gospels, but not least in the women with whom he engages. And I think we see how Jesus, you can only really see Jesus from the ground.
Yeah.
You know, the Pharisees are sort of standing there trying to examine who Jesus is when they're on their hind legs, casting aspersions on him and others. They just can't see who he
is.
Whereas the women more typically are coming to him with need, with vulnerability, with a recognition of their sin and suffering and a need for help. So yeah, it's sort of fascinating. I think we see the angles from which women saw Jesus, and that shines a light on who he truly is, as the one who came not to be served but to serve.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a question for you there, Carl. This may sound really dumb of me, but it was only in the course of this book that I really recognized that women were among Jesus's disciples in the fullest sense. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you've always known, or am I kind of late to this party?
No, I don't think it's something that like I always knew. Like, I don't think I came to faith at 5 years old and was like, yes, You know, but I do think that one of the things, whenever I was going through Bible college, I just had some really gifted female peers, who were always pointing that out in classes that were largely male. And it did make me go and like, be like, huh, let me really look at this. So I remember having a conversation with somebody in college, and it was very similar to what you just said, which is like, you know, I can remember where I was at. And I can remember this person asking me, do you know what the longest private conversation that Jesus has is in the Gospels? And I was like, I was convinced. I was like, it would have to be John 17, high priestly prayer with God the Father. And they were like, yeah, I'm talking like conversation with like another human. And I was like, I don't know. Maybe Nicodemus in John 3. Yeah. And they were like, oh, it's John 4. It's the Samaritan woman. And I was like, there's no way. So I literally opened up my Bible and was like looking and looking and looking. And then sure enough, of course, that's what it is. And that was a moment for me where I realized like, oh yeah, okay. It is very easy. I think it's particularly easy, because most teaching, at least in evangelical circles, preaching and teaching, you get from the from a male perspective. That's the overwhelming, which is like, hey, that's fine. There are some theological convictions that undergird that as it pertains to pastoring and preaching, and that's where I'm at. I know that's where many others are at. But subsequently, you do discover that there are perspectives that you've missed just because they often just are overlooked. And I do think that reading N.T. Wright on the resurrection was another huge moment for me in realizing just how significant what the gospel writers were doing was. Like you mentioned at the beginning of what you were saying a moment ago, that some listeners might be bothered by what I'm going to say, but I don't mean it in any sort of technical, I'm not putting a flag down, but the way that the feminine perspective, that the feminine voice is considered in the gospel accounts is highly unusual for literature of that time. It's even more incredible considering that it's religious literature, and even more incredible considering it's religious literature that views itself as making exclusive, absolute, totalizing claims about God.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you say that the feminine perspective, I think what you're meaning there is the perspective of particular women.
Yes.
Right. Rather than sort of the pink and flowery perspective, like you're saying, the perspective given to us by actual women in the Gospels. And one of the things that's striking is that Jesus has some of his meatiest theological conversations with women in the Gospels. Yep. You know, there's been a mistake that I think, you know, many of us in the church have made in recent decades. So well, we're having a women's event, or we're doing, you know, women's Bible studies or women's discipleship, and that somehow we need to lower the theological level at which conversation is happening, because, you know, whereas men are actually really interested in these kinds of meatier theological conversations, women are basically interested in how to raise their kids. Not that that's also not also an important theological conversation, but, you know, that we tend to modulate things for women. And that isn't something that Jesus does. No. So yeah, it's striking. I mean, there's a host of examples in the Gospels, including when Jesus is at Mary and Martha's house, and Martha's doing this sort of typically feminine things of hosting, and Mary is sitting at Jesus' feet with the other disciples, and Martha says to Jesus, like, "Hey, can you tell my sister off? She needs to get up and help." Mm-hmm. And Jesus says, "Martha, Martha, you're concerned about many things, but Mary has chosen the better portion and it won't be taken away from her." Like, she's actually doing exactly what she should be doing, which is focusing on learning from Jesus rather than the serving stuff, which is not to say, I mean, Jesus is obviously massive on the fact that all disciples are called to serve. So it's not that what Martha's doing isn't right, but like there are very specific ways even there in which he is validating Mary's discipleship.
Yeah. And when you think about the rabbinical tradition that Jesus was certainly he was in those streams, you know, keep in mind for this audience, this Jewish community, having teachers of influence was not somehow like that was not a way in which Jesus was category breaking. There were many teachers of influence, Jewish teachers of influence who had disciples. Discipleship was an existing category in kind of the rabbinical tradition and rabbinical thought. And it makes it even more unusual when you see Jesus invite in women into that kind of inner circle of rabbinically modeled discipleship, this kind of what we see with Mary and Martha, with the sitting at the feet, with the listening to the teachings, with the engaging in conversation. These kind of forms of learning and immersive learning and discipleship were heavily restricted from women in that time. So it's not just that Jesus is saying the presence of God is available and accessible to you, although he certainly he is saying that. He's not just saying I have come for just men. He's also indicating I've come for women as well. But beyond those things, he's also breaking a cultural understanding that the kind of inner circle of religious contemplation, meditation, influence, and engagement belonged exclusively to the men among that people. That is a really unique thing. And he does that over and over and over again throughout the Gospels. And subsequently, we get these incredible accounts of him engaging with women, and we get to see Jesus through the eyes of these women across the ancient Near Eastern world. And it provides some of the most startling and wondrous pictures of what Christ is saying and what he is doing and why.
At the risk of being a little graphic for a second, I think it's striking how the Gospels, and I always want to remember, the Gospel authors are picking from a whole range of stories they could have told about Jesus. I mean, that they had a wealth of testimony they were drawing on. I love how John says, you know, if we were to record everything that Jesus said and did, the whole world wouldn't be big enough for all the books. So we always have to recognize the Gospel authors are picking their stories with great intentionality. And we see we at the same time see women who are treated very much like men in terms of how they're engaging in theological back and forth with Jesus. But we also see the Gospel authors including in their stories things that are specific to biologically female experience. Mm-hmm. And not reducing women to that experience, but including their experience in their relationship with Jesus. So what am I thinking of there? Number one, the early chapters of Luke's gospel, where we see Mary's pregnancy, Elizabeth's pregnancy, and we see their engagement with each other as two women who, you know, Luke could have just told the story in a way which basically made Mary and Elizabeth only the mothers of John the Baptist and Jesus, respectively, which would have been fine. But instead, he pauses and presents both of them to us actually with a prophetic role over Jesus. So it's a sort of both and of, and I think in Christian circles, we can sometimes make the mistake of either, on the one hand, sort of elevating a woman's role as, you know, a potential wife and mother as, you know, elevating that as like what being a woman is really all about. Or on the other hand, you know, perhaps more in broader culture, kind of denigrating that. And I think the Gospels in general, Luke in particular, invite us to recognize, no, these are women who are playing, on the one hand, a very important role of being the mothers of these two extremely important figures, and recognizing their own prophetic role within the narrative. So we have that, and then we have that extraordinary healing miracle of the woman who had been bleeding for 12 years.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Who comes up to Jesus thinking, like, I got to sneak up on him because I know if I can only touch the hem of his garment, I'll be healed. Mm-hmm. I mean, extraordinary, extraordinary faith. And she's the one woman in all of the gospels whom Jesus recognizes as his daughter. You know, he calls her daughter. Right. And this is a woman who's been, is sort of ceremonially unclean from her bleeding. And, you know, represent a sort of extreme form of a basic part of female experience of like having periods, which, you could imagine, especially in a sort of ancient world context, being something that you would want to keep as far away from, you know, this elevated Jewish rabbi as possible.
Yeah.
And instead, that experience is brought to Jesus.
Yeah.
And he 100% welcomes this woman who's convinced, like, she's terrified when he recognizes that the power's gone out of him. She has to acknowledge what she's done. It seems in the story like she's probably expecting to be rebuked for touching him and potentially making him unclean. But instead, he welcomes her and validates her faith. So I just think there are beautiful things to learn from the Gospels about how the Lord sees women in their own right as equal to men, and at the same time includes and welcomes the specifically female experiences which he created.
Right, yeah.
You know, pregnancy, childbirth, menstruation, all the things.
Yeah.
No, I think you're right. And I think it's important for us when we weigh how we are to engage with some of the contemporary conversations that are happening. I think it's important for us to weigh the way that Jesus engages with people in this conversation. We're speaking specifically about women and the way that they view Jesus and the way that they see Jesus. I think it's a good indicator for us that part of the health of our ability to engage meaningfully on topics, both regarding gender and then regarding basically anything else, that Jesus's manner of engagement is probably the best paradigm for ours. I had a professor in pastoral ministries one day who was like, listen, there will be a lot of people who will suggest to you that there are different ways to lead and to pastor, and there's a lot of good tips and practices out there. But at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself, if I have been given the revealed ministry of Jesus among real people in a real place at a real time, shouldn't my ministry, if he's the chief shepherd and I'm an under shepherd, shouldn't that be the clearest paradigm for how to engage with various kinds of people? And of course, the answer is yes, right?
Yeah, I mean, yes, of course, we'll always have to do translation work because you as the pastor of the church are not also the Son of God and the one to be rightfully worshipped by all. Like, so,
yes.
I would want to say the sort of what would Jesus do bracelet. I'd want to say yes, but we obviously need to do that in an intelligent, contextual way, which recognizes that we are definitely not Jesus.
Right.
Because you can imagine somebody taking that in a really weird direction, which I know you wouldn't want to.
Right. No, I guess what I'm saying is that when it comes to the way that Jesus listens, the way that he speaks, the way that he engages with people in vulnerability and in need, the way that he is gentle and kind when that's what the situation necessitates, and where he's direct and authoritative in other situations that require that. I think those are good pictures. And I do think that we see across the ministry of Jesus, even as it pertains to women, it's not as if Jesus is only harsh to men and only gentle with women. There are men and women that he is gentle towards. And then there are other times where he's more direct, both with men and with women. Mm-hmm. Even the conversation with the Samaritan woman at the well, there are some moments of real directness in that conversation that I'm sure, I think it's clear that it startled that woman significantly. But yet he engaged her with that out of a sense of desire to see her really move towards that which was good and life-giving, not to try to demean her or to denigrate her. You know, he does not call out the woman's sin or hypocrisy in the conversation for the purpose of shaming her. That's not what's going on there. He does it in order to illuminate the need, to demonstrate, like, there is something here.
Yeah, and it's striking. Pretty much whenever Jesus is in dialogue with somebody, there is, in the Gospels, there's a push and pull. And, you know, we see that with Nicodemus when he says, you think you're a teacher of Israel, you literally haven't even been born yet. I mean, I kind of love that. I love that moment. And we see it in perhaps the most jarring moment is when Jesus is engaging with the woman who, depending on which gospel you're looking at, is either described as a Canaanite woman or as a Syrophoenician woman. And he says it's not right to take, you know, she's not a Jew.
Yeah.
And she's pleading with him to heal her demon-possessed daughter. And he says, not right to take the children's bread and give it to the dogs. And you think, gosh, that's like, that's a harsh way. I mean, using a sort of slur, essentially, mm-hmm. against Gentiles in that moment. And she says, you know, yes, Lord, but even the dogs get to eat the crumbs that fall from the children's table. Mm-hmm. And it's evident that in the context in the Gospels, it's evident that Jesus is sort of drawing that out from her.
Yeah.
I mean, we've already earlier in his ministry seen him marveling at the faith of the Gentile centurion. So it's not like, I mean, people sometimes say, oh, this woman changed Jesus's mind and like showed him that his ministry wasn't just to the Jews. And no. sorry, that doesn't actually align mm-hmm. with the larger story of the Gospels. But we see this push and pull, and then we see him validating her faith. Yeah. Because once again, the only way to come to Jesus is humbly.
Yeah.
And this woman comes like on her knee, like both literally and figuratively on her knees. Mm-hmm. And when he identifies her, like aligns her and describes her as like a dog, she says, sure, but this is what I'm getting, like dogs get access to. I mean, it's just, I love how Jesus kind of goes back and forth with her mm-hmm. And is drawn out by it, like draws her out in that conversation in this sort of startling way that ends with him validating her faith and doing what she's asked to do. Yeah.
What do you feel like if somebody said, hey, Rebecca, I know you wrote this book. I'm not a reader. What's the big takeaway that you want me to get from this book? What's the one big thing that if somebody told you, I'm not going to read your book, Rebecca. I'm glad you wrote it. I hope a lot of people read it, but I'm not going to read it. What's the one thing that as you wrote Jesus through the eyes of women, you'd be like, I think we all need to hear this.
Gosh, if it was a Christian saying I'm not a reader, I'd say, I'm sorry, you don't have that option. Not about reading my book, but you need to be free. I'd say, sit down and read Luke's gospel now.
Right.
I called my son Luke because Luke's gospel is the one that most especially highlights Jesus's concern for and validation and inclusion of women. I think the one takeaway is that it sounds like a modern project to say, oh, let's look at Jesus through the eyes of women.
Right.
Actually, it's a first century project that the gospel authors invite us into. Yep. And we can't miss it if we actually sit down and read the gospels on their own terms.
Yep.
That women among his first followers had vital testimony for us. Mm-hmm. And if we look at the history of the church and the church today, we'll find that there have always been more female followers of Jesus than male.
Yeah.
This seems to be true kind of across time and across cultures. I mean, you'd look at the church in China today, for instance. It's not just in America. It's not just in Europe. It's not just in the early centuries of the church. It's actually today as well. And that, to me, calls out the falseness of this idea that Christianity is misogynistic more than anything else. It's very bizarre. If it is true that Christianity is at heart bad for women, it's very strange that women have always been more proportionally drawn to Jesus than men have.
Oh man, I could talk about this all day. I am really grateful for the conversation. I'm really grateful for the book. Listen, if you are interested in exploring this more, you should check out Rebecca's book, Jesus Through the Eyes of Women.
If you're not a reader, just read Luke's gospel.
There we go. That's actually, if you are a reader, read Luke's gospel before you read Jesus Through the Eyes of Women.
And John's gospel and really all the gospels.
Yeah, all the Bible, actually. Just go ahead and read the Bible. And then after that, you can start in on the other stuff. Hey, if you want to find out more about Confronting Christianity, you can find Confronting Christianity on Instagram and Twitter. We will be back next season with an incredible lineup of questions and topics. We're still approving the schedule, but stuff like, does science discredit Christianity? What do I do with my doubts? Is the gay rights movement the new civil rights movement? We are going to have some incredible guests joining us for this next season. We hope you'll tune in as season 2 launches in January. We hope you've enjoyed this season. If you want to find out more about how to support Train the Church podcast or Train the Church as a ministry, you can go to trainthechurch.com/support. If you want to leave a review of the podcast, you can drop a question in there and we'll take those questions into account for future Q&A episodes. We hope you've enjoyed the discussion this episode and this season. Grace and peace.